Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. For decades, honeybees have been the main pollinator for foods like peaches, apples, almonds, and so many more fruits, vegetables, and nuts. Pollination alone makes up over half of the revenue stream for beekeepers nationwide. But according to the nonprofit Bee Informed Partnership, beekeepers are losing between 30 to 40% of their colonies every year due to pesticides, a rise in parasites, and poor nutrition. Over the years, we have done several shows about what the declining bee population means for our food system and what it says about the health of our planet. Well, today we are discussing a beautiful new documentary. It's called The Pollinators, and it follows migratory beekeepers and their truckloads of honeybees as they pollinate the flowers that become the fruits, nuts, and vegetables we all eat. In addition to being a vital part of our food workforce, honeybees bring in more than $20 billion to the economy every year. Today we are joined by Peter Nelson, director of the Pollinators. Peter has had beehives in his backyard for about 30 years, and he was interested in making this film to show how important bees are for agriculture and our food system. And Peter joins us in studio. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Thank you so much for making this incredible film. We are also joined by Ben Salman. Ben leads the Bee Informed Partnership Pacific Northwest Tech Team, where he works with migratory beekeepers from around the region and helps monitor pest loads and colony health. Ben's interest in bees began as a child on his family's organic vegetable farm in Wisconsin, where he helped manage the hives. And Ben joins us from Oregon. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. I'm happy to be here.
Great to have you. Well, Peter, I want to start off with you. We have done a lot of shows about bees and this issue on over the years, but it was really a treat, and it's very rare to actually see the role of the beekeepers and just the important role that bees play in actually pollinating fruits and vegetables, and it was really surprising to see how far they travel across the country. Why did you decide to embark on this journey and make a film about this important issue?
Well, I had a great interest in bees, obviously. I've been a beekeeper for a long time in my backyard, and I realized that this story about how the movement of bees was really not known by a lot of people, because mostly it happens at night and on, you know, orchards or farms or wherever, where people don't get an opportunity to see it. So these trucks come in the middle of the night and unload their bees and load them up again when the pollination is done and move them off to the next crop. And so a lot of people don't realize this goes on. And I got kind of fascinated with the work that these beekeepers do, and then also the importance upon this type of pollination to our agricultural system. And I thought this was a good story that really most people didn't know.
Yeah, I did not know that they traveled such long distances. A semi-truck will hold 400 to 450 hives of bees. That's about 18,000 bees altogether?
Oh, no, it's much more than that. It's more like, I think it's like 10 billion bees per truck. I'm sorry, 10 million bees per truck. If you figure about 25,000 bees a hive, that's a rough number, and 400 hives. So it's a tremendous amount of bees that are being moved around, and it's just incredible to experience and watch.
It's really incredible to watch. Ben, can you tell us a little bit about the work that your group does, the Bee Informed Partnership? We actually met one of your colleagues in the film. One of your members, they were doing lab work right after a number of bees died near their hives at an almond farm in California. I mean, it was really sad to see just so many dead bees on the ground.
Yes. So Bee Informed Partnership, we have various tech teams, five across the country, and we work with commercial beekeepers who do pollination and honey, and also queen breeders. So we do a lot of colony inspections. We give beekeepers context to the data that we collect, and we'll do emergency visits. For example, like you mentioned, if there's a pesticide kill, a suspected pesticide incident, we'll investigate. We'll take a lot of pictures. We'll take samples of the pollen that came in, take samples of the dead bees, and we'll send those samples off to get tested to to see if we can pinpoint what happened to them.
Well, and let's just talk about bees. I mean, they're fascinating creatures. And Peter, in the film, Susan Kegley, the CEO of the Pesticide Research Institute and co-owner of Bees and Blooms Organic Farms, says that bees are just so fascinating. The pollination process is incredibly complex, and it mostly works until we get in the way of it. So can you just talk about some fascinating facts that we should know about honeybees?
Oh, boy. I don't think we have enough time. I mean, people spend their lifetimes talking about and learning about bees, and there are just so many things. I know as a beekeeper myself that I just get lost in the world. It's so, as Susan talks about it very passionately, it's a very beautiful social network of these tiny insects that are so important to our life, and they're just endlessly fascinating to watch. And one of the things I wanted to do is try and sort of open people up to the beauty and wonder of these magical little insects, and try and make them accessible, because I think a lot of people have a fear of bees, of stinging insects, and they don't want to sting you. They only do it as a matter of defense. But there are just so many things that the bees do that are just fascinating about the way that they communicate themselves. Where to find forage, when to raise a new queen. I mean, it's just almost an endless topics to discuss about bees. Are just fascinating.
And what would you add, Ben?
Yeah, to me, the biggest mystery is the communication between the bees. So if you think about a colony, they're communicating in complete darkness, and they're using pheromones mostly, and also probably some vibrations. But yeah, the communication has to happen in the colony, and you know, finding pollen and nectar sources and then sharing that information with the other worker bees so they can find that. It's just mind-boggling how complex their caste system is. You know, every worker bee, when they hatch, they almost have a predestined work path, where their first job tends to be, you know, nursing and cleaning the hive, taking care of the other larvae, and then as they grow, they graduate into other roles. And depending on the population and where they are in the season and how many, you know, if they've lost foragers, this, you know, this caste system can change depending on where the needs of the colony. So it's just amazing. And when I open a colony, I just try to be very observant, and a lot of times you can kind of sense how the colony is feeling, if they're queenless, if they are well fed, if they have good forage. You can almost start to pick up on those things. So I feel like I'm constantly learning. Every time I go out, I'm learning from observing.
It's so true. I'm just going to follow up on that. I totally agree. And one thing that's interesting to note specifically is that there's not one bee in charge. It's a collective thinking of a sort of a super organism. So how decisions are made is just, I don't think we really understand that to how, when bees decide to reproduce, when they decide to go out and forage, and for what, and how that all gets transmitted back. It's the queen is there to lay eggs, and the workers are there to do all their different roles as been described. And just that idea of this collective thinking as a eusocial organism and a super organism is just endlessly fascinating.
You got some amazing close-ups, Peter, of the queen bee, and you spoke with a lot of beekeepers about the importance of the queen bee. Can you tell us more about the role that the queen bee plays? And it looks like the queen is just a little bigger than the average bee. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And it's when a virgin queen leaves the hive, she'll go out and she'll mate with multiple drones. And it's interesting, the drones have one role basically in the hive, which is to potentially mate with a queen, not necessarily their own, but another queen. And then once the queen has mated, she comes back to the hive and spends the rest of her life basically laying eggs. And so she'll lay 1,000, 1,500 eggs a day during peak season. And the workers, the attendant bees, they always face her in the hive. And she moves around, and they feed her, and they clean up after her, and they just attend to her. And she's as you said, her abdomen is a little bit bigger. So she's a little easier to spot, but sometimes it's sort of like playing Where's Waldo. on a hive trying to find her. She makes her own special sound when she's a piping, when she's about to be born. It's just she's just crazy beautiful.
Wow, that is really amazing. I mean, the footage you have is just really incredible. The other thing that Susan Kegley said that really struck me is that many crops require pollination by insects, but because the native pollinators are no longer in large enough quantities to do that work, the honeybees have stepped in to take on the role of the pollinator. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, sure. So you know, it's important to know that these beekeepers, these migratory commercial beekeepers, have really responded to the changes in our agricultural system as agriculture has become more simplified. We have more monocultures and larger stands of fruit and vegetables and nuts. Then the bees need to eat, and so they need to have a diverse diet. And so if you have one crop, a monocrop of, I'll just use almonds because we're in California, that blooms for about 3.5 weeks. And so after that, there's nothing really there blooming because they keep, most of the orchards are kept clean so that it's easier to harvest and harvest the nuts. And so therefore, for the rest of the year, there's not a lot for other bees or honeybees to eat. And so native bees cannot live in an environment like that, and they often have a shorter range of flight than honeybees do. So they have to have the habitat in order to live. Some native bees only have a range of a couple hundred feet, and where honeybees can fly up to 4 or 5 miles, and so to find food. So it's really important to have that diversity of forage for all bees. And the advantage the honeybees have is that they are movable. You know, you can put them in a hive, and you can pick them up at night and move them to another location, and they'll come out and they'll find out where the local food is and go about their routine. Native bees don't have that option, and so they sit there, and they're dependent upon what is around them, the resources, the habitat, and the forage that they can find. And so the diversity of forage is super important for all native bees, and it's one of the problems that bees are facing.
And we'll talk about the problems that bees are facing throughout the show. I also wanted to ask you, Ben, can you talk more just about the connections between honeybees and our food system? I mean, to think that one, if you eat a lot of fruits, vegetables, and nuts, chances are today one out of every 3 bites of food that you take basically is thanks to honeybees who pollinate that food.
That's absolutely right. And I don't think a lot of people realize the importance of honeybees to our food system, and it's only increasing. The food system we live in today, or we're part of today, is quite different than 100 years ago. The size of the farms is just growing, and honeybees are, you know, they're not native to the Americas. They're from the old world, and they're pretty much brought in as farm animals. And I think seeing them as wildlife is not really as accurate as seeing them as you know, work animals. They're being worked really hard and being trucked around, and their services are being, you know, exploited and used. So without honeybees, we wouldn't really be able to, you know, eat a lot of the fresh fruits, blueberries, apples. And then besides that, here in Oregon, a lot of the bees are used to pollinate seed crops. So for example, in Madras, Oregon, carrots are grown there for seed, and bees are brought in, and it's even higher densities than for almonds. So many, many colonies per acre just to pollinate a hybrid carrot seed. Then you also have all the forage crops, all the alfalfa that's used to feed cattle, but bees are brought in to pollinate those crops just to make the seeds. You don't get alfalfa seeds without honeybees or other pollinators to pollinate. So bees are, you know, an integral part of the whole food system. And as it gets more industrialized, there's more pressures being put on bees to work harder more pressure on beekeepers to supply large colonies at certain times of year where normally, you know, the colony wouldn't be at its peak population. If almonds start to bloom in February, this is normally a time throughout the country where the population is at its smallest. And so bees are kind of, they're trucked from everywhere, and they're dropped in California, and all of a sudden they're expected to get to work. So beekeepers have to really, you know, they pump up their colonies all winter to try to get them into winter healthy, well-fed, so that they can hit the ground running in February, which is kind of, you know, it's different than their natural life cycle would dictate.
Peter, this was such an interesting part of your film, since Ben is talking about all of the pressure that's now put on bees and beekeepers. In your film, we learn that in California, there are close to 1 million acres of almonds, and it takes 2 hives of bees per acre to pollinate those almonds, so they have to travel across the country. And this is amazing, that the almond industry takes almost the entire national bee supply. It's that big. And in your film, we learn that an almond farmer will call a beekeeper and say, I need bees in just 2 days. And so sometimes they have to be driven from the northern prairies all the way to the Central Valley. I mean, it's just incredible to think that the almond industry just in California takes almost the entire national honeybee supply.
Yeah, it's one of the more alarming things that I saw is the dependency upon one species of insect, honeybees, for that pollination, and so many bees being moved around the country in order to handle that pollination was, it's pretty alarming when you have to move almost 100% of the commercial bees. Now, obviously, I don't move my bees, and many other hobbyists and sideliners don't move their bees, but many beekeepers need to move bees in order to make a living, and so there's so much of their income is dependent upon it. And so, as Ben said, it is a little bit out of the life cycle, and it's not a natural state. And bees are considered livestock by the USDA, but it is kind of alarming to me that so many bees are being moved out for that, and it's just a necessity of the growth of the almond industry in particular, and that's growing as we speak. They're planting more orchards, so it's getting bigger all the time.
And for almonds in California, the going rate is $165 to $225 a hive. That's for 5 to 6 weeks. And when we see the trucks going across the country, I mean, we've probably seen them driving, but we just don't know that there's loads of bees on this truck. We just don't know that they're on their way to an almond or an apple orchard. Can you talk about just how much work this is for the beekeepers? And just because it's so interesting that they have to move so quickly, they get a phone call and they say, we need the bees in 2 days.
Yeah, it was a very interesting experience, because a lot of these beekeepers have long relationships with the growers and farm managers, and a lot of the deals are done almost on handshakes with some of the beekeepers that I dealt with. And you know, they are moving bees around all of the time. It's quite a scene in February and almonds as the beekeepers come in at night, and as you say, it's the trucks, you know, driving down the freeway. You wouldn't recognize it unless you were really looking carefully, because it's a dark net that covers up these beehives that are all on pallets, and so it looks like a cargo of wood or something to many people. And they come in at night and they move so quickly that, you know, these guys can unload a truck in about 20 minutes, 25 minutes sometimes, and then they deploy them into the almond orchards with smaller trucks and all-terrain forklifts. And these beekeepers, another thing that I learned is just how hard these guys work. Is I never knew what was a good time to call them, you know, whether they're sleeping during the day because they're working all night, but they're oftentimes fixing equipment and moving things around and getting ready for the next night, because they're dependent upon the weather and the climate and when the almonds are going to bloom. And if you have rain out in the almond orchards, it's really difficult to move in and out. And yet they have this cargo that is perishable livestock that needs to be taken care of and has to find a place to land. So it's pretty fascinating. The beekeepers just work so incredibly hard.
Yeah, so incredibly hard. And then the other thing that's interesting, Ben, is what happens here in California is so important, because the almonds are the earliest crop in the spring, and then the bees go to apple orchards, they go to cherry farms, and then they go to seed crops across the country.
Yes, so the almonds are the first crop to bloom, and after, you know, the almond pollen is actually quite nutritious. It's very high in protein compared to a lot of other crops. So if the weather is good, unfortunately this year, the weather in California in February was pretty awful, and the bees were cooped up. They don't fly unless it gets to about 50 degrees or warmer. So for much of the month of February, it was drizzly and below 50. So the bees were, you know, they were itching to get out and to get foraging, but they really didn't get any flying hours until later in February. But once they get a lot of that almond pollen stored up, the colonies tend to, at that point, they're growing. They have enough resources. Sometimes beekeepers will give them some supplemental feed, some sugar syrup, to give them calories to fly and collect the pollen and pollinate. But after almonds, the beekeepers are, like you say, they're moving their bees to the next crop. Some of them will go right to the Midwest, North Dakota, Montana, to try to make some honey. Really, the honey crops, a lot of beekeepers see the honey crop as a supplemental part of their business. It's not the main part of their business. Compared to, you know, 50 years ago, honey was definitely the biggest part of a beekeeper's income. Now it's the pollination, and most beekeepers they depend on that check from almond pollination, because that money that they're earning at that point is going to be used to take care of the bees for the rest of the year, for all the equipment, the feeding, the medication. There's a lot of inputs that are needed. So after the almonds are over, a lot of times the colonies they're big enough where they can be split, so the beekeepers can make up some of their winter losses. Like you said, the winter losses have been between 30% and 40%, which sounds high, and it is high, but most beekeepers, they can recoup those losses after almonds when their colonies are large and they can buy queens and split a large colony multiple ways and kind of recoup their losses.
That is Ben Salman. He leads the Bee Informed Partnership Pacific Northwest Tech Team, where he works with migratory beekeepers from around the region and helps monitor pest loads and colony health. Today, we are also joined by Peter Nelson, director of the film The Pollinators. It's a new documentary that follows migratory beekeepers and their truckloads of honeybees as they pollinate the flowers that become the fruits, the nuts, and the vegetables that we all eat. And Peter, we have about a minute before we go to break. You interviewed a number of beekeepers, scientists, about why bees are dying. We've done a lot of shows about pesticides, but it sounds like, based on the interviews you did, it's a combination of pesticides, a rise in parasites, and poor nutrition. Can you talk more about what you found?
Sure. I think that, you know, we like the idea of finding one single silver bullet, something, one answer, one question that is going to lead to an answer of why the bees are dying. But it's really, I think, a multi-tiered, multifaceted answer. And pesticides are part of it. Fungicides are part of it. Herbicides are part of it. But there's also a parasite. The varroa mite is a big problem for all beekeepers. And then also, you know, as we talked about before, the poor nutrition from a lack of diverse forage, habitat loss, and climate change is also a factor in this. So it's a multifaceted thing. And the bees really struggle, I think, with they can handle these things individually, but all of them combined is really a lot of stress on them. And it's not very easy for the bees to make it in many places now.
And the environmental activist Bill McKibben in the film says that bees are a good signal to tell us the kind of trouble we're in. If you're in the Bay Area, you can see The Pollinators this Wednesday at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco's Mission District at 7 p.m. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. This is our One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Every Monday, we focus on environmental issues. In the past couple of weeks, we've done shows about Monsanto losing cancer lawsuits and facing thousands more. We spoke with Mark Shapiro about his book, Seeds of Resistance, The Fight to Save Our Food Supply. And we also did a show with Tim Weiss about his book, Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food. And so many of these issues really are connected when it comes to talking about a healthy planet and where we are going with our food supply. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are joined by Peter Nelson. He's director of the new documentary, The Pollinators. It follows migratory beekeepers and their truckloads of honeybees as they pollinate the flowers that become the fruits, nuts, and vegetables we eat. Peter, has had a beehive in his backyard for about 30 years. We're also joined by Ben Salman. He leads the Bee Informed Partnership Pacific Northwest tech team, where he works with migratory beekeepers from around the region and helps monitor pest loads and colony health. And let's hear from Ray in San Francisco. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the show.
My niece in Sausalito has noticed that the city of Sausalito has torn up the two parks that the bees were always in and have just left the dirt and has it fenced off and is not doing anything else. They're just leaving it like that. And she wants to know who to report the fact that there's no place for the bees anymore there, and they should at least get going on resiling the park so the bees can come back.
Thank you. Ben, do you have an answer for that?
I don't have a specific answer for the caller, but I would say you can always take actions on your own to help pollinators by planting your own yard with a lot of the herbs, culinary herbs, are actually great bee plants, like different mints and rosemary. So that's something that everybody can do is stop spraying their lawns for weeds and plant some of their own plants. But I don't really have a specific answer for the other part of the question.
Yeah, I'm just going to jump in here for a second.
Peter.
Sorry to interrupt, but the University of Minnesota has been doing some really interesting work on this very issue, and some of their scientists have been working with the Parks Department in Minneapolis, St. Paul, I believe, about designing park habitat that is both good for people to use in terms of grass, but also planting stuff instead of grass that is comfortable to walk on, good to play on, but also pollinator friendly. And so I would say that might be a good model to point the city of Sausalito to, because it's really innovative work, and I think it's inspiring to the rest of us.
And I think that, Ray, the Marin County Beekeepers might be a good resource for you. There are beekeeping associations all across California, and I just found one. It's called the Marin County Beekeepers, so hopefully that will help. Thank you so much for your call. We have an email from Jonathan who says, most listeners probably know of the new ideal that we'll as a nation convert to a near meatless food industry. Listening now to me, that sounds like a lot of new work for bees, perhaps too much work. Do they stand any chance of keeping up with the demand of a nation of vegetarians? What are your thoughts about that, Ben?
Yeah, that's a good point. And especially when we look at good quality, healthy protein, nuts are really on the top of the list. So the demand for almonds has really been increasing. And I think that's a good thing. It's good for our health. Unfortunately, I don't know if the industry is growing at a sustainable pace, and the bees are having a hard time, and the beekeepers keeping up with that growth. And another thing that people don't often realize is that most of the nuts get exported out of the country that are grown in California. So
right.
India and China are huge buyers. Southeast Asia buys a lot of almonds. So Americans, we're starting to drink almond milk and eat more nuts, but I think if we're going to rely more on California to produce almonds, we need to do it in a more sustainable way.
What do you think, Peter?
I totally agree. I think it's the idea of meatless Mondays and less meat is a really good idea, and I think it's actually encouraging for not only the beekeeping industry but for native bees and smaller farms, more local farms. I know where we live in the Hudson Valley of New York, there are a lot of new young farmers that are enthusiastically taking advantage of the soil, the good soil that we have back there, and putting up small farms, are 5, 10, 15 acres, and growing a lot of diverse vegetables. And we don't have the nut crops out there that you guys have out here. But I think, it's important to recognize that there are a lot of other native pollinators, too, besides honeybees, that if we have a diverse habitat and a place for the bees to live and forage, they will come, and they will be there. And there's important to know that there are 4,000 different species of bees in the North America about that. So
right.
It's a lot of opportunities there, I think.
Well, and also I think it's an interesting question about, people eating more almonds, for example. I mean, it's a very lucrative industry because especially organic almonds are expensive. And I'd love to know, maybe we'll do a show about this, how many almonds in California, let's say almond farms, are organic versus non-organic, and how much pesticide is used. Because in the film, Peter, Marianne Fraser, a retired senior associate at Penn State, said that bees are very good at picking up pesticides, even if they've been sprayed a year or two earlier. So the bees pick up the residue and then bring them back to the hive. She says that when they got samples from hives across the country, it was shocking just to see how many pesticides they were finding.
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways that plants get pollinated, and I think that's important to make note of, that some things like corn is not pollinated by bees, it's pollinated by wind. And the same thing with wheat and other crops like that. But what happens when that pollen blows is that it blows in the air. And, of course, and it lands, it may land on a squash plant. And the pollen there from that could get picked up by a bee or picked up on other flowers because it's airborne. And so that's the way they inadvertently bring it back to the hive. And it's... It is kind of interesting and a little alarming that there's so much. And the pesticides that we're using now, these neonicotinoids that are sort of the new issue and getting a lot of publicity, it's important to know that they're a lot safer for humans to use, but they are longer lasting and in many ways more powerful to insects. And so one of the things that concerns me is that, and they're water soluble. So you have a long lasting pesticide that is water soluble, and it's going to end up in our water system and streams and affect insect life. And as a fisherman, you know, I worry about that too. And so I really think that we need to focus a lot on using less pesticides. I don't think it's realistic to have a world that is free of pesticides. I think we can get closer to that, but using less and not using them sort of prophylactically. The idea of using pesticides when you see a pest and having an integrated pest management system is a long way towards making good changes in that regard.
In the Pollinators documentary, Susan Kegley points out that these pesticides take years to degrade in the environment. So you'll continue to poison the bees after you apply these pesticides a couple of years after. As she says, unfortunately, they're so widely used, they're really used everywhere now. What do we now know about how these pesticides affect bees? We know that they break down the immune system, right? Which means that they lose their memories and it causes them to get sick.
Yeah, it affects your immune system. And so just like us, you know, if we have a compromised immune system, it means we're susceptible to other things like the viruses that the varroa mite, which is a big problem, a big parasite problem for bees, transmits. And so with a compromised immune system and you have a mite that is a vector for viruses, and there are many viruses that affect bees, they can really have a detrimental effect on them. And some of these pesticides are interesting because they're systemic. And so... like they're coated on the outside of a seed, and then they grow up through the vascular system of the plant itself. So if a pest bites on the plant, it will, you know, get sick and die. But it also goes into the nectar and into the pollen, and that's where it becomes a problem for pollinators, as they pick it up either in the process of their pollination or accidentally. And so it also, when these pesticides stay in the soil, they can get essentially accumulate into other plants. So weeds on the edge of a field that we consider a weed might be a good habitat or forage opportunity for other pollinators. And if the residue of these gets sucked up, it can affect the pollinators. And a lot of times it's important to know that some of these pesticides are not instant kill kind of things, but they are sublethal doses is the term that is used, that it just makes them sick. And over a long period of time, it can affect their immune system and also the navigation. It's another thing that some of these pesticides do, so they can't navigate properly or groom properly or some of the other issues that they face.
Ben, what else would you say about how pesticides affect honeybees?
Yeah, Peter did a great job of kind of summarizing it, but I would say along with the sublethal effects, when they do the testing for the pesticides, they usually are testing adult bees. So even though maybe an adult bee won't die from exposure to this chemical, They're bringing it back. It's in the pollen, and they're feeding their brood these chemicals. And I think sometimes we see brood damage that maybe that chemical didn't kill the adult bees, but you're seeing, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later when they start to feed that pollen to the brood will get sick. And it could even be months later where you start to see signs of pesticide damage, but it's really hard to know where that came from because it could have been months earlier where they collected that. And there's also many the synergistic effects. So, for example, fungicides alone might not be that harmful to bees, but when you mix a type of pesticide called insect growth regulator, you can have really powerful, deadly effects on bees. And also, there's more and more work now being done on the microbiome of bees and humans, but some of these herbicides may be affecting the gut bacteria in the bee, which can make them more susceptible to these other intestinal parasites and other brood diseases.
The Environmental Protection Agency recently banned 12 neonicotinoid pesticides from 3 agrochemical companies, Syngenta, Valent, and Bayer Monsanto. Now, 7 of these pesticides are used as a protective coating for crops like soybeans, cotton, and corn, and this came out of a legal battle. Peter, how important is this decision by the EPA for bees?
I think it's a huge step. The other factor that happens with this, just to divert for 1 second, is that these coated seeds, you know, sometimes when they plant the seeds is a bad problem because they're coated on the outside of the seed, and depending on how they're planted and the type of machine that they're planted with, there's a dust that comes off of these things that can be lethal to insects and bees, in particular honey and all pollinators. But I think it's huge, and I think that it's a step in the right direction, and they really, as has been said, you know, testing just the adult form of the bees is, I really believe that we need to test these things more thoroughly and test them before they're released. You know, why do we have to have bees that are pulled off the market? Why do they ever get on the market if they're not safe?
Well, and also it's important in places like North Dakota. You interviewed Zach Browning, the co-owner of Browning Honey Company, and he said that in 2000, there were only a few soybean fields in North Dakota. And then in 2006, George W. Bush gave a talk about biofuels. And as soon as that happened, the renewable fuel standard was created, and they saw massive changes in North Dakota. And so now the two predominant crops there are corn and soybeans. He says we've lost so many opportunities for producing honey due to these changes. More traditional crops have all been replaced with corn and soybeans. And he says that there's just little forage and there's a lot of pesticide there. In fact, it'll take about 20 years for the soil to come back to sustain life because of all the pesticide use.
Yeah, it's really alarming. I mean, what they had a program, and they still have a program called the Conservation Reserve Program, and what that would do would that the government would set aside land for farmers, ranchers, to land that wasn't exactly good for planting on crops would be set aside for a conservation reserve, and that was a really good opportunity for forage for bees. But that really changed. A lot of that land has gone away because the subsidies for corn and soy for biofuels is just irresistible to some of these farmers. And so a lot of that land, North Dakota, South Dakota, in particular the Great Plains area, has been historically a tremendous area for honey production in particular. And a lot of that area has been changed over into corn and soy. And we drove out to North Dakota and South Dakota, and I jokingly said to one of the beekeepers that I expected to see some corn, and he said, "Yeah, as soon as you hit the Pennsylvania border, the west side of Pennsylvania, that's pretty much what you'll see." And he wasn't really off. It was corn pretty much everywhere we went, all the way out. And it's not natural to see one species of crop, you know, or two species of crops, and just going on as far as the eye can see. It doesn't seem right to me.
Ben, the new rule from the EPA says that these companies can continue to sell and distribute these products until 2020, and then after that, they're banned. And so this is going to make a huge change in places like North Dakota, where these crops are just so common. And I mean, even in the film, we saw, you know, the difference between the soil that has been heavily, you know, dosed in pesticide versus soil that hasn't. There's just a major, major difference. So what are your thoughts about this ban?
I think I have mixed feelings about the ban. I do agree with Peter in that these chemicals are pushed out too soon before they're really tested thoroughly. The neonicotinoids, they replaced in large part a class of pesticides, or organophosphate type of pesticides, which are actually a lot more harmful to other animals and humans. So I guess my one concern is that if these products are going off the market, I wouldn't like to see farmers going back to the old class of pesticides, which are not as selective to insects. The neonics are way more toxic to bees. And so even in tiny quantities, they're deadly. So yeah, it'll take years and years to, you know, let the soil recover and purge these chemicals out. But as the current trends is towards larger, more industrialized farms, I'd love to see, you know, like Peter said earlier, more smaller, diversified organic farms. That would really be the most healthy thing for the Midwest and for the beekeepers and bees.
Well, and in fact, a number of farmers you interviewed, Peter, say that they would rather not use pesticides because it's a major expense. And they say the problem is that citizens are now demanding fruits and vegetables year-round, whereas 10 years ago, we could not buy certain foods every month of the year, and now we can. And he said the problem is people are demanding fruits that don't have any blemishes. And so that is due to pesticides, that they can actually make those fruits that look, quote, perfect because of pesticides?
I think it's a factor in it for sure, and I think that's you're touching on an important point, which is what consumers are asking for and expecting to see in the supermarkets. And the idea that in New York State that I can walk into virtually any supermarket and buy fresh, unfrozen raspberries is not normal. And I like raspberries, but it's you know what the consumers demand and expect when they want to see a perfect apple and perfect and piles of perfect apples and perfect fruit. And I think that, you know, pesticides go a long way to make those more perfect fruits. So it's a consumer demand that is a big part of this. And it's also important to know that, you know, some of these farmers, there are a lot of innovative farmers that are making strides into doing things better, and not only from an environmental standpoint. And farmers are very pragmatic. The farmers that I know and the ones that we interviewed in the film is that they look at that and they talk about inputs. And Ben mentioned this earlier, inputs for beekeepers, but inputs for farmers is like, if I don't have to spray something on the crop or on the put it in the ground, then it means that it's more money that's going to end up in my pocket. And so it's a bottom line decision that is very pragmatic for many of these farmers, in addition to the fact that they do not want to be exposed to some of these chemicals. So it's a multi-tiered thing. And if, you know, the farmers are really, really interesting group of people, and they you know, they look at those input costs very carefully, and they look at what their bottom line is very carefully, and there's a very competitive business, and so it's a important factor for how much they have to feel they have to put in. But like one of the farmers that we had in the film, Lucas Criswell and his father, they're sort of innovators, and there are a lot of these farmers across the country that are doing things in not a new way. It's an old school way of cover cropping, and they're using cover crop instead of herbicides to build the soil, but also keep the weeds down. And so you're getting, you know, sort of two benefits at the same time with the crop rotation, cover cropping that builds the soil up, and when the crop lays down, it covers the soil, so they don't have to use an herbicide in the field to do that. And that's a win-win-win situation because they don't have to spend money on the herbicides and the time to spray it. So there are a lot of really interesting and innovative things that give me hope that are going on in agriculture now.
Well, let's take our last caller. Let's go to Mia in San Francisco. Hi, Mia. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for this excellent program. So I have one question and one point. I don't believe that there is a required labeling for plants that homeowners and regular people buy in the nurseries that reveals if the plants have been grown in with the use of these toxic pesticides. And it would be so great if that could be more widespread and consumers could make informed choices and maybe even at nurseries ask or demand that there be more less pesticide use. And the other thing that I would say is to dovetail on what one of your guests said about the big factory farms, and he'd like to see smaller, organic, more diverse farms. All of your listeners should remember that you guys all, most of you have gardens, and you can plant bee-friendly flowers and sort of, in a way, be like a little tiny farm or little landing pad for the honeybees. And that's all I've got.
All right, thank you. And to add to your comment, Mia, Louise writes, why are people not being encouraged to plant white clover? We replaced our lawn with clover, and now we see lots of honeybees. The clover looks great and does not require much water. What are your thoughts, Peter, on what people can do in their own backyards?
Oh, yeah, it's one of the things that gets me so excited about this whole project was the fact that, you know, the situation with pollinators is a little bit dire, but what I really love is the fact that this subject matter is very actionable, and there's a tremendous amount of things to do, and Mia touched on that and sort of the other person who wrote in. Planting clover, you know, my yard right now is dotted with white clover. In fact, we did a whole bunch of filming in our yard because I, you know, could just go out and lay down in the ground with a macro lens and film bees on clover in my yard, and it's just, and other insects. So I think that, you know, that, you know, planting stuff that is not, grass is a monoculture. Let's be clear about that. And if we're all lucky to have enough to have a lawn, just changing the way that we look at it and having green grass is maybe not the best way to go. But having dandelions in there or clover is there is equally as beautiful to me and much more beneficial to, you know, to the insects and the environment. And as they touched on, I think the person who wrote in touched on the fact that having these little pockets of gardens and farms is really important. We mentioned before the range of some of the native pollinators here is very small, 100 feet sometimes, 300 feet, half a mile. And having these little stepping stones where bees can or pollinators can have habitat and forage and go from one to another is really going to be part of the answer. And there are just a ton of things that have been mentioned before about planting, you know, planting gardens, educating kids, holding your legislators accountable, getting on the local council and allowing beekeeping, and then also pushing for pollinator gardens at schools and parks and changing those things. And really importantly, going to stores and asking questions, right? Asking questions about where your food comes from, how it was grown. Go to the farmer's market, talk to the farmers. And if you're buying plants, if you went into a garden center 15 years ago and asked it for a neonicotinoid-free plant, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. And now growers are becoming more educated about this. They don't want to hurt the environment. And so I think that it's a very fair, actionable thing that people can do is go and ask what people are growing and how they're growing and if it's sprayed. And if people, more people ask those questions, we're going to get to a healthier environment. I really believe that.
Ben, what would you add? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, I totally agree. I liked Mia's comments, and I think it does kind of come back to the consumers. You know, a lot of the big box stores, they have been pushing back against these labeling requirements. They'd rather not have to answer those kind of questions. But I think if consumers are going into these stores and asking, you know, have these plants been treated with neonics and kind of make us think about it, I think that actually gets things done a lot of times. But yeah. Tearing up your lawn would be great. A lot of people like to have a perfectly manicured lawn, but I think just showing by example that there can be other types of beautiful lawns or front yards that can be full of diverse native species, I think as people see that can be beautiful too, they'll jump on the bandwagon.
And finally, Peter, we have about 30 seconds left. Are you, what kind of reaction are you getting from this film? Are you hearing from farmers who say that they would like to change their practices when it comes to pesticides? in order to save the bees and also really save the soil and then save the planet? What are you hearing?
Yeah, we're getting a tremendous response to the film. I mean, you know, first of all, people are you know, in awe of the fact that there move bees around, but people really want to be able to do something, and I think that that's it's just been great. And one of the biggest jolts that I get is after a screening, the next day I get an email from somebody who canceled their, you know, their spray on their lawn, or you know, decided to start to take a beekeeping class or planted a garden. That's the biggest jazz I get, and we're getting a tremendous amount of response to the film about this, because I think that if we all do something, we can all collectively make a difference. It's a scalable solution here, and I think that, you know, getting people active and making them aware of this is a first important part.
Well, it definitely increases your appreciation for bees and beekeepers for all the hard work that they do. Peter Nelson is director of the new documentary, The Pollinators. It follows migratory beekeepers and their truckloads of honeybees as they pollinate the flowers that become the fruits, nuts, and vegetables we all eat. Peter, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your work.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate you putting me in Studio B, too.
Thank you. Ben Salman leads the Bee Informed Partnership Pacific Northwest Tech Team. Thank you for joining us, Ben.
Thank you so much. Thank you for what you do.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
Or tweet us at 1A.